All right, everybody, it is 12:59, and as we approach the top of the hour and recording has started, I am going to kick us off with some housekeeping rules for today. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Kluwin for those not able to join us live today. Please use the Q&A box during this training to ask any questions, make comments, or report any technical problems at any time. We will be responding to questions throughout the training, so feel free to put those into the Q&A pod whenever they come up. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click a box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be provided to you. The feedback form can be found on the Kluwin training page that brought you here today. All right, so on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's training, ITRC's Environmental Data Management Roundtable, focusing on data exchange. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online resources on environmental data management produced by ITRC in 2022. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, also known as the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Kluwin. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to become a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website to learn more information. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide number four, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them are not only volunteering today for this training, but also were a part of the original data management team, and so obviously could not have done this without them. Would like to say a big thank you to all of them for joining us today. If you would like to learn more about their backgrounds, their biographies are included on the Kluwin training page that again brought you to our training here today. So with that, we are going to get started. So I am the not only facilitator but also the moderator today, and again I have the honor of being joined by our expert panelists here, which are going to talk about the ITRC EDM guidance document. All of our trainers span the US and have years of experience with this topic. Again, we encourage you to read their full bios on the Kluwin training page. This roundtable is one of the three that are meant to be a training for the guidance, and they are part of an overall training catalog, which also includes a 10-minute overview video and a discussion of the traditional ecological knowledge. From 2021 to 2023, the EDM team worked to develop the guidance document, which is available on the ITRC website. I encourage you all to bookmark the link and explore the material, which is divided into topics and various fact sheets. What we're going to discuss today is based on the guidance, and we'll refer to those fact sheets frequently. The scope of EDM is quite broad, ranging from data planning and collection to governance and accessibility. But today, our discussion is focused on data exchange. Although we will, of course, touch on all the other topics as they affect data exchange, which hopefully is what you're here to learn and talk about. We want to hear your questions. If you haven't already, please familiarize yourself with the Q&A pod and type in any questions that you have throughout our training here, and our panelists will discuss. We'll start with a few frequently asked questions, and then we will dive into the live questions as they come in. So without any further ado, we are going to get started. Our first question for our trainers: what in the world do you mean by data exchange? Let's get to up to speed a little on the language that we need to be able to communicate effectively about this subject.
Yeah, thank you, Devin. And thank you everybody who's joined for listening in. We're certainly glad to have you. To define data exchange, it really is fundamentally the process of sharing data between environmental data management systems. And in many ways, it's really about making data accessible. When we talk about data exchanges and in the context that we're going to be talking about them today, we can sort of think about them mostly as data exchanges that are planned in advance and that can occur with regular frequency, though we will kind of touch on some instances where data exchanges may not be necessarily planned or just sort of one-off kind of things and some of the strategies that differ there. But really, you can kind of think of these data exchanges as data that's coming in or data that's going out, or think about things such as sort of the source data set and the destination data set or data system. One typical example that you think of when you think about a data exchange, particularly one that's done with some regularity, is an instance of where you've gone out, you've planned some field sampling, you've collected samples, you send those samples off to an analytical laboratory, and then that laboratory is going to send you back the data from their analyses after every sampling event. And so that is a really good example of a planned data exchange with some regularity. You're going to be getting data deliverables, which is another concept that we'll talk about. We'll talk about EDDs, environmental data deliverables from the analytical laboratory, and then, of course, the strategies that you take to bring those in. There are many components of a data exchange, and we're going to talk about a lot of them here. One that I'll just sort of kick off with is your data system, and the databases from the source database. We're going to have to really follow some rules. And one of those rules and concepts that we'll talk about is valid values. And there's a fact sheet that we have in our documents in specific about valid values. What is a valid value? Well, one kind of easy example that you can think of is, date formats, right? What is your date format that you've established for how you want to be able to bring in data? Is it year, month, day, or is it day, month, year? And do those valid values differ between different data sets? So one common challenge that we deal with when performing a data exchange is making sure that we translate those data from one set of valid values to another.
Yeah, and going off of what Brian was just talking about there, one thing that can help us out when we are working amongst various database systems and data management systems on those valid values is remembering that you don't have to create these from scratch. Adopting existing accepted valid values from other authoritative resources can really be helpful to ensuring that data transfers go smoothly and that you're using kind of a similar language to other things across the way there. You can go through and check other authoritative data sources for trying to find these valid values. And sometimes they don't even have to be environmental database management sources on there. So if you're trying to find the name of a chemical or a chemical abstract services registry number for doing work like Brian mentioned about getting analytical data from a laboratory, for going through and getting that information from a submitter for field sampling or something along those lines, you can check those places, which again exist outside of the scope of an environmental database management system, but they are well known, well identified, and accurate across the way there. Or if you want to keep things going and really help out and make it so it's easier to transfer your data between environmental database management systems, you can use published reference tables from these established systems. Many agencies, many groups will publish those out there. EPA will do it for STRET, the agency I work for, which I'll talk about in a second here, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency shares our reference values widely for everyone there to help facilitate our data transfers and exchanges on there. You can find a lot more of these than just the two that I have mentioned on this in our resource list as part of the documentation, part of our ITRC product that all of us worked on for a few years that was mentioned earlier on there. So in addition to that, too, putting another plug in for that guidance document, there is a note in the historical data migration case study portion of the document that talks about work that my agency, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, did to help facilitate data transfer, to do a large-scale migration from documents into a database on there. And we went through and reviewed a number of different valid values from other EDMSs, from other reference sources to help get that work up and running.
In addition to what Michael said, it's important to consider that as you incorporate these valid values from other organizations, like the example Michael cited, it's a good idea to validate the definitions of those valid values as they pertain to your organization. particularly if things change over time, if there is definitions that are perhaps unclear or ambiguous, it's a good idea to check those against multiple sources so that you have the best value for your needs in your data management system.
When receiving routine data from a data provider, such as a laboratory or a field staff, it's often in the form of an electronic data deliverable, which Brian mentioned earlier, or an EDD. There is an entire fact sheet on EDDs for those who want to take a deeper dive into them. An EDD is basically a structured data file that places a particular data item in a particular column in order. It's possible to work with the data transmitter so that they populate this EDD to reflect the rules governing your target EDMS, including being, you know, valid values consistent with your system. And the goal here is to facilitate a smooth exchange of data between the source and your target EDMS. And as we also mentioned, you know, usually data exchange is this, you know, recurring some frequency process, but sometimes you're doing more of a one-time event, such as receiving data from a legacy database. In that case, the data might not be consistently formatted, which can increase the cost of migrating it into your database. There's another fact sheet entirely dedicated to this concept of data migration, which can be consulted for more information on that topic, with the idea that data migration is kind of a special subset of data exchange. The primary difference being that there isn't, you know, this nice existing export-import process between the source and target. And typically these are one-time events and can sometimes be referred to as historical data migrations, as they're often used to import like older legacy data, but they're not always older data.
Another distinction to be made between those one-time data migrations and a regular data exchange. One-time data migrations are often referred to by the acronym ETL, or extract, transform, and load. So you may see that. And one of the important distinctions also is not just the terminology, but the fact that an ETL process is typically done by one party, the person who's pulling in, say, historical data from a document or another data system. Whereas data exchange implicitly has two parties involved, one on each end. And that difference means that there's an opportunity during data exchange for some discussion, negotiation, clarification, if there are ambiguities in valid values or formats or whatnot. So an important aspect of this data exchange is that you can actually have some discussions with other parties that are involved.
All right, thank you, trainers. So now that we have a little bit of a better understanding of, you know, what the language is that we're using here and exactly what data exchange is, can you all talk a little bit about how to handle receiving data from a laboratory?
I'll kick it off, Devin. Again, this is a typical use case that you have with data exchange. And so what you want to endeavor to do is communicate with each laboratory that's supplying you with data. Make sure that you document for them as a data provider the schema of your environmental data management system. The schema basically says how the data is organized, and also the valid values that are applicable that you want them to use in order to bring that data to you. Wherever possible, you know, the most efficient way to get that data in is with an EDD format, like Tori mentioned earlier. And you want to make sure that that format is properly documented with the appropriate schema annotations, as well as the valid values, so that the data is exchanged as close to right the first time as it happens.
Once you've communicated your organization's needs to each lab, it's also good to establish a tracking system of formats and valid values that, you know, each lab has and should be sending you. And then on top of that, every time you receive a deliverable from the lab, it's good to do a preliminary QC of it. A lot of data management systems do have kind of built-in software to check against your system's valid values, but little things like checking that if you have a well at your site that's in your system consistently as MW-01, that it didn't end up in the EDD as MW-1. There can also be nuances with some of the chemical data, such as, you know, some of the hydrocarbon ranges or nutrients, where like they might pull a valid value from your system, but the way that your system has it defined may not fully match what you intended the sampling round. There's actually a really good case study on USGS water quality monitoring data as far as like nuances to keep in mind in data exchange, as far as just consistent approaches to handling things across systems. And the good thing about this tracking sheet is that you can use it to document any steps you had to take to transform your EDD, whether they be minor structural modifications or finding and replace valid values to be consistent with your system. And that these steps can be used ideally to communicate back to the lab that you needed to make these changes. And it'd be great if they send you exactly what you need going forward. If for some reason the lab just, you know, can't get that in place for you because they're like a small boutique lab, they might not have a great IT infrastructure. The other upside to having this well-defined tracking system is both to make sure just generally nothing falls through the cracks as you receive EDDs, and that you could use it as the basis for a script or some type of low-code automated approach to save yourself time if this is a routine high-volume exchange.
Right. And I guess to follow up with that, you know, it's important to take a little bit of a step back, you know, when you're dealing with laboratory data, to really try to understand the structures of both the source data from the laboratory and your destination data in your environmental data management system. It is important, I guess, even taking a further step back to really define what we mean by EDMS or environmental data management system. There is a white paper in our documents that I highly recommend that you go and check out if the concept of having an environmental data system and choosing an environmental data management system, if that's new to you, please go ahead and head and check that out, because there are some important considerations to think about, you know, if that's something you're setting up. But presuming that you have something in place, right, understanding your structure and, of course, the EDD structure that you're going to be getting from the laboratory, probably based on their LIMS, which stands for Laboratory Information Management System, that's going to be important for you to do. You may have to do some restructuring to that data because of maybe the way that the laboratory handles replication, subsampling, resampling, compositing, et cetera, et cetera. How that gets represented in the format of the data deliverable that you get from the laboratory may be a little bit different from what you have to have in your environmental data management system. So some restructuring may be important to maintain data integrity during that entire exchange process.
Yeah, and both building off of what Brian was mentioning there, going back to my earlier discussion about valid values and answering a question that we have in the chat that's pertinent to this topic, where Kelsey asked, do you have any advice on comparing different lab qualifiers to reference values, and what do you do if the definitions don't line up? Something that's really helpful that we found at my agency and amongst the professionals here is to establish a translation table. And these translation tables can help you convert the quote-unquote foreign valid values, so the valid values that are used in another EDMS, into those valid values that are used in your system. This can be done before the incoming data are received. So if you have a laboratory that's set up to submit your data for you, you can send over a reference value file or something else that contains your translation tables to them to help do that communication from lab to lab beforehand. So their experts can go through, check, make sure that the qualifiers, that the matrix codes, the media codes, all that good stuff match before they even submit it to you. And you can take a look there. You can do it on your end too if you need to do a rematch or remap, something along those lines, using those same translation tables. But what this really does is this increases your efficiency for receiving the data, and it increases the reproducibility of the data import process. It's not up to, you know, if you've got a translation table that goes through that either the lab or the EDMS receiving the data uses, it's not up to me feeling great on a day saying, well, I'm not going to double check and see if these are supposed to be groundwater or WTR-ground on this. I'm going to send it through and they get some errors on that end. It makes sure that it is kind of removed from the human process of this and goes through and keeps it reproducible and keeps it consistent. This also works the opposite way. If you are trying to export data from your EMS to another system on there, you can use these translation tables on that portion to convert them back to what the lab had originally, to another agency's format, to other sets of data that may be used for those communications, those data transfer processes. It That being said, on here, even if you do have these translations tables set up, it is important to quality control and check these deliverables received in case there are some issues coming across. If there's valid values that are not part of your translation table need to be added, maybe the lab updated their LIMS and now there's new values that need to be put through there, or your automated system is missing something because you recently redefined how you describe surface soil versus subsurface soil across the way there. So the automated solution helps with that reproducibility to make sure consistency, but it's always good to double check, have that quality control, and to see that your requested format, your values that you're getting from the labs, from other submitters, are continuing to provide the correct translation between EDMSs.
Another facet of the data exchange with analytical laboratories to consider is, what do you do if you are getting data from a small niche or boutique laboratory? And again, these organizations typically don't have sophisticated LIMS systems like Brian mentioned. They may be doing specialty analysis for environmental forensics, like hydrocarbon fingerprinting or GC fingerprinting, or there are new analyses for emerging contaminants. So things like, again, the recent example might be PFAS, where the method is still a bit of a work in progress. And these are considerations that you have to take into account when, you know, you have valid values that might be coming in the system. As Michael said, check and verify. If they don't have a sophisticated LIMS system, you may get the data in some sort of simple format that you need to, you know, transform in order to bring it into the system that you're using.
Hey, thank you, trainers. Just a quick reminder, we are getting some questions in our Q&A pod here, but a reminder to our attendees that we are taking live questions, so feel free to put anything into the Q&A pod at any time, and we will review and discuss as a training group.
Hey, Devin, before you move on to that next question, there's one in the chat that's actually somewhat relevant to this one about laboratory. And Robert asks, what about, when you get the same lab qualifier that has different definitions across laboratories? And that's a very good question. We do see that where laboratories, may have different, they can kind of make their own definitions in some sense. There are some standard qualifier definitions that you'll find in, the National Functional Guidelines, for instance, kind of have a general set of qualifiers that are used somewhat nationwide and are somewhat an industry standard, but laboratories can kind of take that and run with it in all different directions. And many times they do. One typical way that I've seen deal with this, and I encourage others that maybe have other ideas, is maybe come up with a unified set of qualifiers. Some people call it an interpreted qualifier, where you take those qualifiers from the laboratory and you make some sort of interpretation and sort of unify those or merge those into one qualifier set that comes into play. Kind of going back to what Michael talked about, you can have translation tables. Maybe you have a laboratory that, every time they have something that is a Q qualifier, well, that really actually means something like a J or a J plus or something like that. I'm kind of making those up out of whole cloth, but those are the kinds of examples when you just almost have a lookup table and you translate those laboratory qualifiers into some sort of unified qualifier set that you have determined and you've got set up in your valid values in your own data management system. So that's typically how it's done, but I encourage others, if they have other ideas or seen other examples, to bring that up. But it's a great question, Robert. Thank you.
Yeah, just to add on a little bit, one of those ways in which you can sort of merge different letters that are used as qualifiers is to structure your EDMS, your environmental data management system, so that it doesn't necessarily store those codes, but it stores the meanings. For example, some of the important meanings that are associated with chemistry data is this an estimate? Is this rejected? Those are true-false determinations, and they can be stored in your database as true-false flags, Boolean values. You don't have to store the letters. So you can use the translation tables to translate one lab's letter to estimated and a different lab's letter to estimated all within your system to get the same meaning, despite the fact that the sources have different encodings.
Yeah, and kind of building off of what both Brian and Andreas mentioned there and tying into the translation table idea earlier, when we provide translation tables, we being the state of Minnesota, we include the code, the number, or the letter or combination thereof in addition to that meaning. So there can be that trust but verify process that we talked about earlier with Dan as well. So you can make sure that that Q qualifier, that Q plus one qualifier, the labs aren't just blindly accepting it and say, oh, our LIMS spits out a Q qualifier. It's got to be the same as what this agency or these people are looking at, but they can do some of that mapping themselves as part of that trust and verify process to make sure that, it's not just saying Q in lab one's schema in their valid values list equals Q plus in the MPCA's list, but gives that description of it. So every party, the lab, the receiving group, and the database itself are able to do that translation and double check and make sure that you're getting things correctly.
Thank you, trainer. I just had trouble getting my mute off there for a moment. So what do I do if someone whom I'm receiving data from doesn't provide a tabular electronic data set?
Right. So in the examples and what we've discussed so far, we've really been talking about structured data, which is something, tabular data, rows, columns, sort of what one might think of when you think about data. But it is good to bring up the concept of unstructured data, which, is data that does not have an explicit schema or doesn't really follow patterns. And there can be a number of different examples of these kinds of unstructured data that we could talk about, but one easy one that might be something that I think folks can key off on is field notes, handwritten field notes. And those, they're very important. There's a lot of information that's gathered in that way. But that data might be taken and something like this. Oh, it's not showing up. There you go. Field notes that are scanned in and, maybe take a picture of them, and that's what you have. And that's really the thing that you need to do, you're given, you're provided with scanned copies. What do you do with that? Well, depending on your schema and the planned use of the data, right? And those are very big dependencies. You may need to add structure to that data. That adding structure might actually be just keying in those data elements that are important into your data management system, into a tabular form. Sometimes it is just taking that data and archiving it into a place where you can note where the location of those scanned copies of those documents are and note that in your database. Sometimes that's sufficient. All of those things that you might need to do in terms of that translation of that information is really a form of data migration. And it's important that we bring that up here.
Yeah, some of the issues associated with import or migration of unstructured data are, first, your system may not have a place for some of that information. Second, you may need to recode, essentially create valid values for all of that information. And third, the level of effort may be beyond your current capacity. So some of the things you need to consider when faced with that kind of unstructured data, particularly if there's a large volume, is that you may need to prioritize and limit some of the data that are to be extracted from that unstructured data.
And speaking as a employee of a regulatory agency, sometimes you have to just be aware and be consider the fact that sometimes the parties are averse to providing the data in a readily accessible form, be it tabular or structured on there. In some cases, it may be a smaller boutique lab, as we discussed earlier, where the lab may not have the technology available, in a case where you can work with them, establish a data flow, work on the translation tables, get those EDMSs talking to each other, or get a functioning LIMS in place for it. Sometimes it could be a strategy. There are certain things where you may have some contentious legal opinions on sites where things are going through, and someone may not have explicitly said this needed to be in a tabular format. So someone may want to put them through in a specific format on there as it stands as part of their process, or it could be that they don't care. Maybe it's a quick little brownfields redevelopment and that program doesn't require any sort of electronic data submittal process. They've got their letter that they need to go through and get their redevelopment done, and they're ready to move on. So there's all sorts of reasons why this may happen.
All right. Thank you, trainer. So we do have a question here from the audience. In your opinion, as a training group, how much work is appropriate to ask your lab to do when talking about EDD preparation?
I'll weigh in on this, Devin. So it's a good question, and as I mentioned sort of at the top of the discussion as it related to documenting your schema and documenting your valid values, it's a two-way street. You know, you have, if you make a good faith effort to document how you need the data formatted and the valid values that you require in order for your data to be usable, then the laboratory needs to put forth a good faith effort to provide it in that format at a level of quality that you expect. If they don't, find another laboratory. You know, that's the value of competition. So again, there are obviously, with depending on the type of EDMS you have, whether it's a commercial system or a bespoke system that you've developed yourselves, it's that level of documentation. Is it understandable? Is it, you know, is it clear? Do you provide examples? That goes a long way for the laboratories of various sizes in order to be able to give you a quality electronic deliverable.
Yeah, I'd like to add that the answer in part depends upon how much work you're going to give to the laboratory. If you ask the laboratory to develop a custom EDD for you, they're going to bill you for it, right? They're not going to do that for free unless you're going to give them so much work that they can just hide the cost in their regular billings. So you really, it's a question of budget as much as it is of compatibility and technology.
And speaking from experience here, we made it a requirement at the state of Minnesota for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in our remediation division to have data submitted to us in our prescribed EDD format. This happened for all sites last November, and we required it for our more intense Superfund sites a few years ago as part of that. So sometimes the labs have to do it, either to meet contractual obligations that are signed already on that where they're supposed to do it, or to meet regulatory requirements where that need to be put through that. I've stepped through and helped onboard a bunch of labs to get EDDs ready for it, either walking through step-by-step on the remapping themselves or sending off our reference values and then just being able to take it and run with it. But sometimes it does take both parties to get these EDD preps. Sometimes it takes the lab who's submitting the data to you, and sometimes it's a coordinated effort with either the regulatory agency or the company that is asking for the data in that format.
Yeah, and we got one other question in here from Dusty, who says, does anyone know if an agency is connecting laboratory LIMS directly to regulatory EDS for compliance data submittals? I don't know for that specific question. I don't know that I know an example of that, but I guess I could speak a little bit, and this kind of touches on some comments that were previously made. Most of the conversation we've been having is in a commercial setting where a commercial laboratory that you're paying and you're billing or they're billing you. You know, that concept is a really good one where, you know, there is a commercial incentive usually for that laboratory to provide the data to you in the format that you ask for. Right. There usually is some commercial incentive or there will be because they will bill you, as Dre has pointed out. What you kind of get at a little bit here, Dusty, is a situation that does come about if you are in a regulatory agency and you get data from an internal laboratory, and so you have to deal with directly with the LIMS system that your internal laboratory is using, and there are many challenges that come up with that or that can come up with that because you have to there is no commercial incentive for that laboratory to provide the data to you. You just have to sort of negotiate in terms of internally how that goes. There's more I could say about that, but it's much beyond the scope of this particular Zoom and this particular topic. But it is definitely, it can become a challenge, and I'll just leave it at that. But it can also enable instances where you can have close collaboration and close integration that you would never be able to have with an external laboratory. So there's pros and cons, like I say, beyond the scope of this, but reach out to me if you have more questions.
Yes, and adding on really quickly, I can say that yes, we are doing this not directly through the LIMS to LIMS, even though we have our Department of Health that runs a lot of our analytical samples for us at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. But we recently rolled out a data submittal portal that is CROM Air compliant in the state of Minnesota. So our solid waste data under our permittees that are required to do that, it's no longer just transcribing it yourself, but the labs, the solid waste permittees who open or operate open landfills, construction demo landfills, solid waste landfills, all those good things can send their regulatorily required sampling for groundwater, for vapor, for gas, all that stuff, to a system that meets CROM Air compliance and integrates with everything there. So we've got one that's about a month and a half up and running. So it's been working well so far, but fingers crossed, still early in the process.
All right, thank you, trainers. So we have a question that asks for how to handle a certain request of when someone asks for all of the data, but with no specific format. So how would you recommend handling such a request?
I'll kick this one off. Usually I work with whoever's making the request to try to get a better sense of their intended purpose of the data because, depending on who's requesting it, is it a risk assessor, a 3D modeler, somebody just trying to prepare their annual groundwater monitoring report? They might have very different needs. And a lot of the EDM guidance document kind of talks about the importance of terminology. So I think, asking a lot of clarifying questions because a word that the other party's using may not mean the same thing that you're interpreting it to mean. Yeah, I guess short answer, just keep communication open and try to get an initial sense of what they want. And then obviously make it clear that as you get to an initial export, you're very happy to work with them to both slightly edit the format, follow up with additional requests if they need some, figure data as well. And that if they notice anything in the database that doesn't seem, quite right to them, that getting that external set of eyes from a, subject matter expertise on the database is really good, feedback to make sure it's in good shape.
Yeah, and I'll add that that's actually, in my experience, a very common request that somebody says, "Give me all of the data." And if it's a group with which you've worked before, and if you have a well-established set of data management staff, they may have produced that sort of data in for the similar types of users before. They may already have a semi-standard internal EDD format that they have used. So that's a good place to start. If the party requesting doesn't say this is a format I want, then typically your internal data managers or data providers will get to an acceptable format through some back and forth negotiation processes, as Tori suggested. So it's maybe a little glitch or a little bump in the road, but it's actually a good process to have that back and forth. Overall, though, it's worth keeping in mind that there are some pretty well-established formats for data exchange, and that's particularly true for analytical chemistry data. But when you get into more rarer or more esoteric data, and biological data is a good example. If you're looking at species abundance data, you're looking at toxicity test data, you're looking at bioaccumulation test data, not only do those study designs differ a lot sometimes so that the underlying data have structures that are not as similar as chemistry data is, but the needs for those data can differ a lot too. So there's actually a lot more need for negotiation sometimes in when you're dealing with somebody who's requesting non-chemistry data.
All right, thank you, Joyous and Tori. So I just received and or found a bunch of data. What are the questions that I should be asking before I start thinking about migrating it into an EDMs?
Yeah, so probably the first question to ask or think about is what's the cost versus the benefit of those data? Because there are trade-offs. Data management, data migration, data exchanges often costly, particularly if you don't have well-established procedures and formats. So in dealing with that evaluation, cost versus benefit, you really need to collaborate with the data users to consider where those costs and benefits lie. And in particular, you might look to the project managers or the technical users of the data to get the best sort of judgment of the value of those data. Conversely, you might look to the data managers to get an estimate of the costs of migrating or exchanging those data.
Yeah, and building off of what Dreis just said there, it is important to get buy-in from all the parties on this, from the data managers who are going to be managing the data, to the project managers who are familiar with the cost, to the technical experts who know what's going on. If you leave the decision of the data migration to just a data manager in one case, you know, you won't necessarily get what you need. They may not be aware of all the aspects of the data that are important from a regulatory or technical perspective on there. It may just seem to be a throwaway field that's only rarely populated to a data manager, but a subject matter expert, a person using the data, may look at that and say, whoa, that's actually super important for all the work that I do. This needs to be included because this is an automatic rejection if this field is filled out or something along those lines. It makes the process much more difficult, much more labor intensive across the way there, but you do need to consult with your subject matter experts, and especially for those of us who are at regulatory agencies, with the end users, the people who are going to be using that data for regulatory, for technical, for public communication purposes.
Right. And so going back to the concept of cost, to state the obvious, the more complex a migration or a data exchange is, the more costly it will be. But how do you define complexity, right? It really depends on quite a lot of things. And, you know, you can say that something is complex in the sense that, like what Dreis was mentioning, there are some data sets that have added complexity and potential complications, like biological data or biotoxicity data, et cetera, et cetera. But if those data sets that may be complex to understand have a really well-defined workflow in terms of getting the data in into your EDMS, then that really is, from a data exchange standpoint, a very simple data set. Whereas you might have something that might seem very simple, some field data that again is in a handwritten in some field notes, that it becomes a little bit more complex because there's the added complexity of the added effort that it has to go into getting that data off of some handwritten field note and into something that's more tabular, right? So this concept of complexity is something to consider and something that you just want to make sure that you ponder before going down this road and really committing to a data exchange like this, or particularly a historical data migration.
In addition to the complexity compounding costs, as Brian just mentioned, another fact to consider is that just migrating your data, putting it from one system to another system, won't change the quality of your data. And it can be easy to muddy the costs of kind of going back and double checking that quality with the cost of the migration, because obviously that's really important. I think this gets back to talking to the data users, making sure that there's value to migrating that data, because once it's migrated, if it's actually going to be used, there is merit to checking it. And on that note, if you have 10 years of data that are in some type of other fairly structured EDMS that's been used consistently by someone with eyes on it, that will be much easier to migrate and sleep well at night knowing it's in decent shape than migrating data that might go back decades and include paper copies, because there'll just be like a lot more QAQC to do before you can confidently use that data to make project level, risk level decisions. You don't know for sure if the paper copy that got dug out of a file cabinet was the final version. You don't know for sure if it accounts for any data validation that might have been done on those results.
Ultimately, as we've all been talking about here, the key question that Dreis and Tori and Brian have stated, and Michael, it's about doing a check against how good's the data, what's the quality, and how useful is it to you. If you don't know, you can't determine because of either the age or the quality of the deliverable that you received, then you might want to conduct an audit and, separate out the data that is, perhaps of suspect quality or suspect usefulness, and save it for another day in order to have cost control.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So, how should I get started with a data migration?
Oh, I'll take a stab at this, Devin. So first out of the gate, you wanna, understand the scope of your migration. So you wanna conduct an audit, or sometimes that you hear it referred to as an inventory, and develop your strategy, your migration strategy. Identify the chunks of data. Chunks is a highly scientific term here, that you want to migrate. The most valuable, you should migrate first. And again, value here is defined by what's the purpose of the data migrating in the first place. Is it for legal reasons? Is it a high profile project and you need to want to get the data in first? There may be other categories of that you want to use to organize it, whether it's time period, over the last calendar year, matrices, sample media. You could do it by location. So if you have operable units or areas of investigation that you want to focus on, then you can use that as part of your strategy to develop your migration plan. And by doing that, you may find that there are methodologies that may slightly differ from each other, but in the process, it'll make it more efficient rather than applying a methodology broadly across the entire historical data set, which in the aggregate may be less efficient. And we have a white paper in the guidance documents that the team prepared that talks about data audits.
Yeah, just foot stomping the concept of a data audit and its importance, while you're before you really start with a data migration or exchange of any type. I mean, studying and documenting the structure of both your source and your destination data sets, it really goes a long way in clarifying at the outset what your strategy is going to be for this migration. And additionally, putting this audit together, I think it's really valuable because it allows you to leverage, the work that you've done putting the audit to define metrics of data quality. We're going to talk about data quality a little bit. We're going to touch on it if you or happen to follow these roundtables. We had a roundtable similar to this on data quality a few weeks ago. There's a data quality section in our documents. I highly recommend you check those out. But if you've got that data audit kind of put together, it can allow you to really define these metrics that you wanted to use for data quality. And again, there's dimensions that are mentioned in the documents about data quality dimensions. One of them that's a good example is, and it's a very obvious one, is to check for completeness, right? If you've got a very big or terribly complicated data migration or exchange, it's easy to overlook things, overlook portions of a migration. Maybe you forgot to include your QA/QC data or certain pieces of metadata or things like that. If you've got a data audit put together and you know what exists in your source data set and you know what you want to see in your destination data set, you can really plan and perform completeness checks at the end of any migration. And it's just a really good way to double check yourself.
Yeah, one of the data quality issues or dimensions that we've talked about a little bit already is that of consistency. And we've talked about valid values and translation tables. So those are ways in which we help to establish consistency during the data migration process. And incompleteness, as Brian just mentioned, is another element or another dimension of data quality that typically needs to be addressed during data migration. It's important here when talking about the interaction between these two processes, data migration and data quality assessment, is that once again, to emphasize the fact that you need to have multiple parties knowledgeable about this process, not only the data managers, but the data users and other project staff as well. The responsibility for data quality as well as data migration really must be shared among multiple staff. And I'd like to actually go into a question that was asked here. Somebody asked, Trudy Watson, asked if there are any tools maybe for taking unstructured data like toxicity data in PDF or scanned PDF formats to help get those into a structured format. And ITRC doesn't endorse specific tools, but I will tell you what kind of approach that, well, we use and I would recommend. And that is to get it out of PDFs, even to get it out of spreadsheets into text formats as one of your very first steps. Because there is a wealth of tools for manipulating text data, CSV data. And I'm not going to list them all, but if you're familiar with sort of the Unix philosophy or Linux tools, there are a lot of tools for manipulating text data, for slicing and dicing and aggregating it, and even maybe pulling it into a simple database, maybe SQLite, for example, to do other aggregations using SQL. So without naming a whole lot of specific tools, I would recommend that the first step is to move it from esoteric and difficult to work with data formats into something that's more common and that has a lot of tools for it. That's text.
I'm sorry, Tori. Go ahead.
I was just going to second what Treya said, that, you know, I know there's a lot of open source scripting software out there, not naming any names, that you can use. Even you can even point them at a PDF. They'll kind of convert it into script text format, and then you can use various like string parsing functions to add structure to them.
The other thing I was going to mention that sort of goes hand in hand with this is an area where image analysis and OpenAI is seeing a lot of movement. I'm working on something now, which is involving looking at image analysis for graphs and parsing that data back out to a raw format, which the tools that Dreas and Tori were talking about that are open source can then, you know, transform into an actionable data deliverable. This is an area that's seeing a lot of interest across the board, whether it's looking at an actual image or looking at like an image of a graph and parsing out the graph and into the data points accordingly.
Yeah, and Dan, you hit a really good point there, and something that Trudy mentioned in her question as well is that a PDF or a scanned PDF are actually very different when it comes to that data migration process itself. You know, OCR has come a long ways in recent years. It's a little bit easier to get those scanned PDFs to work with a number of tools that might be out there to get them through there. But if you have a PDF that was generated by a lab out of their LIMS, or that someone had as a Word document that was then saved as a PDF, that becomes easier to parse through, work with what with Tori, Andreas, and Nels, or Andreas, I was reading your last name there, Tori, Andreas, and Dan were talking about there, to bring those across, to get those throughout there and to get them into a more workable format. So that's all part of that data audit stage, that work to go together and making sure you have enough time, enough effort, enough energy budgeted, because it's a lot easier to bring in a correctly formatted PDF than to spend the time either using machine learning to train it or having an army of student workers try and double check and see if your one is a one or if it's an L that's being scanned in through the OCR process. Sorry, optical character recognition. Shouldn't use acronyms without defining them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the AI realm is really exciting, and there's some of the things that I've seen, just even that your phone can do with certain things, seem like magic, and they are really cool. I just would caution, at least at this stage, and this cautionary tale may be somewhat outdated by the time someone listens to this, if this is being recorded and you hear this 2 years from now, but it just seems like you should really trust, but maybe just don't trust. Make sure you verify, because I think that a lot of these techniques, when it comes to data, that there's money on the line, there's liability on the line, there's things like that on the line. For I don't know that I would put a lot of trust into a generative AI kind of model to be able to do that. You definitely want to take whatever steps that you need, and maybe doubly so when it comes to auditing the data that ends up coming out of some sort of a technique like that. So anyway, yeah, this is probably, again, we're maybe getting a little out of scope of this particular group's stuff. AI is very much cutting edge techniques, but definitely something to keep an eye on.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So our next question talks about automated migration versus manual. So in what scenarios would it make sense to use an automated migration versus when might a manual approach be preferred?
Right. So I think it's important to, you know, what do we mean by automation? I think when we're just going to be discussing this, I think we're really going to be talking about writing a script or generating some sort of a code to, you know, try to deal with data that comes in, work with it algorithmically, you know, doing some sort of a process, building a recipe or something like that to transform the data to then do something with it and do it in an automated way, right? So you can think of it like a recipe, right? A code is really like a recipe. It's, you know, you get ingredients in, you do some process, and you get hopefully something delicious on the way out. But, you know, you just have to be, there are many benefits, but there's also some downsides to these kinds of approaches. Some of the benefits are cost savings. Potentially, if you can get a script to work and you have a mountain worth of source data that you need to process, the cost savings of not having to do that manually using human resources to do that can be really great. You can have transparency because code is something that you can share and somebody else, other people can critique that code, can look at that code, can see exactly what the process is. In some ways, this gets to documentation as well, because essentially your code can kind of document, you know, particularly if you put good documentation notes kinds of things about what your code is intending to do. You know, you can have that be looked at by others and people can critique it or and see exactly what the process is if they understand what's going on there. And of course, reproducibility, right? This gets to the same kind of thing. These are the benefits of doing this. You can, you know, potentially if you have a data set that or a script that you write for a particular kind of data that's coming in, well, if that data continues to come in, well, then that your costs, whatever you sunk into the building that script is continuously being, you know, you're seeing that work being paid off over and over again every time you get a data set, and that does not, you know, requires much less work every time that happens. What are some of the costs? Of course, availability of skills, right? If you don't have the skill sets available in your shop, you're not going to be able to deal with that. You do have to make sure that the data sets that you're going to be bringing in are suitable for coding, right? If you have a lot of exceptions to your data, if the data is not very regular in the way that it comes in, that data set might not necessarily be amenable to something where you would want to automate, or the automation might be so complex that it just becomes the costs outweigh the benefits. So a lot of things to keep in mind, and I think others are going to document or discuss a few other things, but this is sort of some of the things to keep in mind when considering automation for data migration.
Brian gave a lot of really great reasons to automate, and I just want to give a shout out to section 3 of the Data Migration Best Practices Fact Sheet. Has, you know, a nice written out list of things to consider as far as when you might want to take an automated versus a manual approach. And, you know, kind of as Brian alluded to, it does say like the more the better with automation, but it's also good to really go in with a clear plan based on the inventory and audit that we discussed earlier in this roundtable. And kind of like a compartmentalization strategy. Brian mentioned, you know, the importance of considering skill set, where, you know, obviously a lot of the people who have the most customized automation skills are usually in pretty high demand. So you might want to really look at that audit and then kind of funnel the work that really needs that skill set to those people and then figure out what you can tackle with low code, no code, or what might even be a good task for somebody who's just a very detail-oriented person and it kind of needs, you know, manual eyes on it, either because it's QC or it's one of those more like kind of niche unstructured data files that you want to migrate. And another, you know, important point to keep in mind is just to keep communication open throughout the process, especially depending on how large the migration is. Things very probably will go wrong. And it's good, you know, that's another reason why that kind of inventory was good for developing a strategy, because you might find yourself in a situation that, oh, you're out of budget and you migrated the highest priority 30% of your data set, and you need to just kind of hit pause if that data is not immediately needed for a project deliverable, and, you know, see how the budget pans out the next year.
Yeah, and I think it's worth reiterating that as far as cost savings goes, it's ordinarily less costly to QA an automated migration process once or maybe a few times as it evolves, as it will, than to QA every data set as it's migrated. And where that balance falls depends upon how many data exchanges you're going to do of the same type. So if you're going to only do one data migration or data exchange of a certain type, then the cost of automating it may be comparable to the cost of QAing just that data set itself. But if you're going to do 5 or 10 or 100 data migrations, then you're going to be well into the regime where the cost of the QA or the automation process is much lower than the cost of QAing every data set. And the QA process develops documentation, which is also, in essence, a part of your quality process. The documentation helps you ensure to yourself and to others later that, in fact, the data has met a certain standard of quality.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So we've been talking about cost a little bit, and to keep within that train of thought, how do we control cost during a data migration?
Yeah, so I can talk about this and put in another plug for the case study that's located within our documents about Minnesota's historical data migration process for it. And one thing that we found in our project at the MPCA was that you really need to have a broad range in your expected cost on it. The migration in the case study, not to spoil it, if you haven't read it, and if you haven't read it, you should, so don't let me discourage you from doing that, is that we had multiple efforts to try and migrate data for our state Superfund program, which is the program I work in, into a database system. And it existed as documents, as PDFs, as scanned copies, as physical files and boxes in faraway storage areas scattered across the great state of Minnesota. And it had been tried 3 or 4 times. And every single time they had budgeted too little time or had expected folks to do it on their own free time to try and go through and do that, which it was tough. And when we sat down and finally put pen to paper, got the numbers out there, it came out a lot higher than anyone else expected on that too. So just make sure that you have a range of expectations. Sometimes these migrations will cost less. Sometimes they will cost more, but make sure you bracket those as it goes through. Touching on what I mentioned as well, it helps to have dedicated staff to do this, which is an unexpected staff cost sometimes, or dollar cost, as the case may be, to get all of the groundwater data for our Superfund sites in Minnesota, which we have about 90-ish state-led Superfund sites here. It took 3 years, 6 full-time staff, a personnel budget of $400,000 to pay for those staff, in-kind contribution from existing MPCA employees of another about $400,000, and close to $15,000 in IT costs to get this data migration done. So we, rather than try it in a skeleton crew to get things going, we went out and got dedicated funding through the Environmental Natural Resource Trust Fund, which is a Minnesota-specific option that we have that allows us to take money from gambling proceeds and help save the environment on this stuff. So having that dedicated staff, having the dedicated funding really helps out, and is something that needs to be considered on it. Otherwise, folks are going to get looped in and it may fail as you go through. Again, feel free to read, actually, please read that case study. It's a great example of what you need to consider, how you can control the costs, and how your expectations may be higher if you've never done this before.
Right. It's, you know, data migration, particularly for historical data, for data that's older, that's, you know, it's variable, and it can be very difficult to predict in advance, you know, how things are going to go. You know, this is where some of the things that we talked about before, the concept of data audits, things like that, are really important. You want to make sure that you have as good of a sense as you can when you go into it about how things might go. And then, as you know, you might start a data migration, you really want to try to control these costs and things like that by monitoring progress, and really by prioritizing what data is the highest value. You know, and that's going to be a very subjective thing. And it's something that, you know, once you perform that audit, you're going to want to basically assign a value depending on what your needs and objectives are about what those things are, so that you can, if, you know, costs start to balloon, and you know, you can maybe take some portions of the data that are not as of high value and put those to the side and potentially, you know, wait for additional funding or do some other time or potentially just leave off the table altogether. You know, it's you know, we kind of mentioned before that data migration is a good opportunity to improve data quality, make it more usable, and all those things. And those it is that for sure. It is that opportunity to do that. But you know, you really want to make sure that when thinking about costs, that you kind of consider those two things separately. You know, if the data is not correct in the source, you know, correction costs or data that cost of actually correcting the data. You know, there's this concept of garbage in, garbage out. You know, if the data is too difficult to correct in the process of migration, it may need to be abandoned. There's just many things to consider. I can't go into too many specifics. This is not quite the venue to do that, but always make sure to take care of, you know, and do as much as preparation things that you can in advance, such as those data audits, so that you can really try to consider things in the big picture and monitor things as they go along.
Yeah, I think Brian's absolutely right there. And a factor to consider is apply those traditional project management principles to the data migration task. Things like, who are your resources? What's your schedule? Do you have stakeholder buy-in on what is valuable, what's not? Additionally, you may want to engage those stakeholders to do acceptance testing of the data after that QA check, because that'll also help you validate and control and address any kind of cleansing tasks that may creep in over the course of the migration if they're not explicitly called out. With regard to cleansing, the other thing to keep in mind with this is if you do elect to do a cleansing exercise as part of migration, you want to absolutely make sure that you have documentation on that cleansing so that you've got an audit trail of what changed from your source to your target, because that may come into play for legal reasons as well as if you're doing any sort of transformation of historical values to new values in your EDMS, as we talked about at the very top of the call, in order to facilitate data reporting and other aspects.
Yeah, and I'll just add that the dynamics of all of this is actually quite complex, because automation itself can have different short-term and long-term costs. The sometimes co-occurring activities of data migration and data quality assessment or improvement can have very different costs. Just to throw out a couple of other very quick case studies. These aren't in the documentation, but another example of a very costly project was one where some data was collected over three different field seasons using different study designs, different field crews, frankly, insufficient documentation standards for the field work. The field work over those 3 years cost about $750,000. Integrating the data and cleaning it, migrating it, costs about $1 million. More than the actual field collection and lab work. But in contrast, we had a case where we had to pull in data from a set of laboratory instruments that had been generating data files over several years. There were 11,000 data files. It took about 4 hours to write the script to import it, and the computer chewed in that script for 2 days, and it was done. So those are kind of extreme different ends of the cost spectrum for automation and data migration. And where your data are going to fall, it's hard to say, but that's something that you need to assess and figure out really as early as you can.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So I am going to make one last verbal call for any live questions for our trainers to answer here. If you have anything else you want to ask, feel free to put it in the chat. All right. We have a few coming in. All right. I'm just going to read right from the Q&A pod, trainers, and we'll see if we can get some good answers for our attendees. In the absence of an in-house environmental data management system, what recommendations would you have for establishing one from the ground up for smaller analytical data sets, anything under around 200 samples? What are important considerations for establishing preferred data formats and data translation procedures, most often from Excel, in a way that maintains data validity and allows for a later comparison to regulatory standards?
Well, Brian mentioned this earlier, but there is a white paper that addresses data management systems specifically with some recommendations or guidelines for what kinds of things to think about, different levels of detail for systems, and when you might want to choose one type of system over another. So I find it hard to give you a very detailed answer to that specific question, but I think going to that ITRC white paper on data management systems would be a good place to start.
Yep, you took the words right out of my mouth, Dreas, on that. There's actually a wonderful table in that white paper, which I linked for everyone in the chat directly to it on it, if you're not aware of that, that talks about the different levels of EDMSs that you can have, your decision matrices, your amount of cost, effort that you need to go through to evaluate and see if you want to do paper files or spreadsheets, you know, individual database softwares, multi-user databases, commercial off-the-shelf databases, software as a service, all that good stuff. So we're using that term pretty widely as it applies here. And I think that white paper is extremely pertinent and will help answer a lot of those questions.
Yeah, and one other thing, I guess it, you know, if you're really starting from kind of a blank sheet of paper, you know, I'm reading your question again. I just want to make sure, you know, if you have to later comparison to regulatory standards, or if you have a destination that, you know, you need to process some data and then say report it to a state agency or to EPA or to some other thing, or if there is some destination, check with that. Wherever you need to report that data to, or whatever it's going to be used for, if there is a standard data template or something like that for that group, that could be a good template to start from, essentially, and to make sure that at the very least you're gathering the data that sort of meets the business rules of wherever that data needs to go. So if there are certain columns that are necessary, if there are certain valid values that you'd want to align to, you know, those are the kinds of things you'd want to do a little bit of research on. To make sure, especially if this sounds like it's just sort of a one-off thing, if this is going to grow into something bigger, because in my experience, there are a few, but not many things that seem to just be like one-offs. You know, things tend to grow. If you find a problem, you're doing an environmental study, say you find the problem, and then that problem needs more study. So it is building small is sometimes can have some payoffs because that's all you need, but eventually it may come to a day when that's not all you need and you need to grow bigger. And sometimes growing from building bigger is sometimes more advantageous, but that's somewhat covered in the white paper. So we should definitely check that out.
All right. Thank you, trainers. All right. So for our last question here, I have for you all, what are the biggest risks associated with data exchange? And what are some methods for mitigating those risks?
Oh, good question. Risks. Well, you got to remember, you know, one of the elements of data quality that we've sort of discussed, and we certainly encourage you to go read in the white paper is integrity, data integrity. You know, you're the steward of your own data. The data that you report, the data that you report to a regulatory agency, submit out to the public, you know, essentially this is your agency's responsibility. And so, you know, you really want to do all of your due diligence to make sure that you don't have incorrect data. You know, worst case scenario, you could get sued. Some regulatory decision gets made on bad or erroneous data. Boy, that's the egg on your face. You don't want to do that. So I think the main thing is when you're doing these, if you only look at one element of data quality, you should look at them all. But if you only look at one, completeness and correctness is really one of the main ones that you want to make sure that you're doing that with. That said, I think, automation is one potential solution that you can use to help with that, because there are a lot of things. I mean, we talked about this to some extent, that automation can allow for reproducibility, for documentation and things like that to be able to help with a lot of those concerns. But yeah, that's really the main thing, is just make sure it's correct in what you're doing.
Yeah, and ideally you have a quality assurance process incorporated into your migration system, if not into your organization as a whole. And that QA process, if applied correctly and efficiently, should be less costly overall in terms of both effort and risk than QAing every data set, a point we've made before. But documentation is a key aspect of that QA process. All of the QA checks that are incorporated into your migration process should be thoroughly documented. It's important to know, too, in terms of risks or potential risks or apparent risks, that sometimes migration may necessitate some changes to data. For example, if you start with a system, you're migrating data from a system where chemistry data records all of the analytical laboratory replicates and reanalyses. So you have multiple analytical results for a single sample and analyte, and you're migrating that into a system that only stores one result for each sample and analyte. Then during that migration, you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to average all of those multiple results, or you're going to have to select one of them to be represented in the target system. Somebody can come along later and compare those two systems and say, hey, these are different. There's an error here. Well, it's not necessarily an error. Okay, you can have good data quality and data integrity in both of those systems, even though some of the analytical results are different in detail. So that's the kind of thing that can occur during migration, even when you're establishing data quality, that needs to be comprehensively documented.
Another key point in maintaining data quality is to make sure that data managers are never working in a silo. I know we've touched on this across our responses to a few of the earlier questions, but that's just, really important to ideally integrate each data manager into the project team for which they're managing data to make sure they actually have some idea of like the context in which the data is being used that can help them to make sure they don't make judgment calls that might make perfect sense to from a data management perspective, but might not make sense from some other contextual perspective. It's also really important to make sure that the data management system's as accessible as possible to the project team. This can be through, setting up some type of dashboard portal that the project team can kind of like get the data on their own as needed and then be seeing what's in there and it's transparent. And then just making sure that the EDMS is consistently being used for reporting that, some of the project deliverables aren't starting to take on their own lives where the project team, you don't have this really nice transparent feedback loop. And again, just kind of reiterating that, you want to make sure you're having both of these factors in place because there is this risk that there's so many different potential specialties in the environmental field that within one subspecialty, something that could get encoded in a database one way might get interpreted by someone else some other way. So it's just very essential to make sure no one's in a silo.
Yeah. And as Tori mentioned, we're talking about environmental data working on this. Environmental data can be directly related, especially in the field of work that I'm in, to remediation efforts, to mitigation efforts. We are out here observing, measuring, analyzing real data out in the field that can have direct impacts on people's lives. In some cases, your data exchange, if you're a regulatory agency like I am, can directly impact health-based risk assessments. If you have an improper migration, someone may have some decimal places off and a well that is purportedly supposedly clean could be off because someone didn't convert between micrograms with the U shape on the front with the mu to nanograms correctly or vice versa across the way there. So it's important to keep this all in perspective. Our incorrect data that we deal with in the environmental field can lead directly to real life issues. And these risks, these issues that come across are associated with the data exchange, especially when you're bringing things together. So it's a good bit of perspective. I have to do a lot of talking with residents for issues with groundwater, surface water, with soil, with vapor intrusion into their homes. And I always feel more confident if I've got good data, well-documented QAQC data that I know is accurate and representative to those folks to make sure that we're able to alleviate their fears or let them know what's going on.
I think the other one of the risks that you run or can run as it relates to data exchanges, your EDMS solution, whatever it may be, could end up being a problem for your organization if you don't have adequate data governance around it and governance around data exchange. Each item that you don't plan for can cause a headache. For example, if you don't consider data security, will you have a lawsuit filed if there's a data breach? And the team has put together data governance checklists, which are in section 2 of our data governance fact sheet and section 6 of our data accessibility and security fact sheet. If you don't have a methodology for handling how you handle updates of data and how you do retention, data retention, which we have a fact sheet for that in our data lifecycle fact sheet, it's sections 3 and 6. Is your data going to become irrelevant because the users can't get real-time data when they need it, or contemporary data when they need it? Or what if somebody has a great data set that would really augment yours, but you don't have a data dictionary to document how to integrate it? In section 2 of one of our DSDD fact sheet, we talk about data dictionaries. And so if you think through all these items in the fact sheets that the team has put together, that'll set you up for success. Even if you don't have answers to everything, that's okay, but at least you've at least thought through it and can understand potential pitfalls for not having it planned out in advance. So I would encourage you again, the proper planning prevents poor performance. That sort of rings true here for data exchange as well.
All right. Thank you so much, trainers. That wraps up our content questions. So I'm just going to end with a few logistical notes here, and then I will wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day. So I'd first and foremost like to thank our expert trainers for joining us or for being here today, and all of our attendees for joining us. Big thank you. We obviously couldn't do it with either of you, so we do appreciate the time taken to host these and to view them. We would like to hear back from all of our attendees today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that is located on the Clewin training page that brought you here, and that is also the way you will obtain a certificate of completion for today's webinar if you are interested. If you would like any further clarification on any questions or answers provided during today's training, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org. Our trainer's information, again, is also on the Clewin training page if you would like to reach out to any of them directly. So with that, I would like to wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and thank you very much, trainers. All right, thank you, everybody.